ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley from ABC News Daily, the podcast that brings you one big story affecting your world each weekday in just 15 minutes.
I hope and pray I will still be able to stay on the NDIS because at the end of the day, autistic people are getting targeted.
Join me for ABC News Daily. Find us on ABC Listen.
A post-budget roadshow without any budget bounce. As the Treasurer and Prime Minister continue their big budget sell across the country, new polling shows voters are yet to enthusiastically swing behind the changes. But Jim Chalmers has defended Labor's reforms, suggesting he wasn't expecting a post-budget bounce and fixing a broken status quo in housing is worth the near-term political costs. Meanwhile, the coalition is facing some internal backlash of its own, with a key moderate condemning his own party for creating two types of community members by pushing taxpaying migrants off welfare benefits. Welcome to Politics Now. Hi, I'm Patricia Carvalis.
Hey, PK. I'm Jacob Grieber. And you're looking surprisingly bouncy and energetic, actually, given
that's me.
We're still in the lee of budget week.
I'm bouncy by nature. But there's no bounce to this budget, my friend. Boom, boom.
That was so beautifully done. Yeah, it's almost like we scripted that. We didn't, dear listener.
Like, but we've been practicing all weekend. This budget doesn't have lots of goodies in it. And so there was an inevitability that when you tax people more, and some people will be taxed more, that it will annoy some people. So I am not at all surprised that the two polls that came out this morning, we're recording this on a Monday, showed a negative reaction. One extra point, they broke election promises to deliver these things. And, you know, I've been arguing on this pod that there is something collective, a sort of build up to breaking promises that can happen. And I do think that's what's happening here, that the government has breached trust with the public and that is going to hurt them and it's not a small thing. What do you think, Jacob?
Yeah, look, so some of the numbers that these polls, and as you said, there's two that have come out on Monday morning. News poll, 47% of the people they surveyed, about 1,200 people, think the budget will be bad for the Australian economy. They're saying that's the worst score for a budget since the 1993 budget, which I have to say that's I was pretty young then, PK. I think it was at university. So that one I don't remember so well, but it is the famous LAW law tax increases that Paul Keating brought in was very, very damaging to him politically. And I guess the other one that is the benchmark for quote-unquote bad budgets, the 2014 budget that Joe Hockey and Tony Abbott brought down. So this at the sort of level of asking people, do you think the budget will be bad for the Australian economy, has landed sort of in a negative space. And there's been a little bit of a shift in One Nation's primary. They've gone from 24 to 27%. Coalition's slipped a little bit. Labor's pretty much unchanged. So people aren't changing their votes necessarily between Labor and the conservative side of politics, but they are worried that this hurts the economy. So that, to me, is a bit mixed, but the government's got a lot of work to do here selling this budget, convincing people it's the right thing to do. Don't you think? I mean, they're going to force it through the parliament, so it's going to become real very soon.
And that is, you just nailed it with the forcing it through. So the last budget, which was as unpopular as this one, was Tony Abbott's 2014 budget. And we remember that. Well, I do. Lots of broken promises in that one as well. Lots of radical things that upset people, things like, you know, co-payment on health, like stuff that did not pass the public's test of what's fair. But there was one big difference. And this is why Labor thinks that they are on a potential still winner and they're not yet, you know, as the political saying goes, wetting the bed, yet being the key word. Tony Abbott couldn't ram it through his Senate. He didn't have the ability to do that, and so it just lingered and lingered. They couldn't get the reforms through. They just kept bleeding support. It was deeply problematic, and then most of it didn't happen anyway, right? So it kind of built a head of steam, the hatred towards it. The difference with this one, and it hasn't happened yet, but I will predict as night follows day, the Greens will not stand in its way. And that's because I think the smart people in the Greens, and there are a couple I've spoken to, can see the train wreck coming and realise that, you know, it is at least in the direction they believe it should be in, even if they don't think it goes far enough. And so the government might get its wish, and its wish is, privately told to me and then even publicly really confirmed by the Prime Minister in my interview with him last week, they want this all done and dusted by July. So it's all done. It's all legislated. People get used to it by the time we go to the next election. It doesn't have the same lingering, festering stinkiness of the 2014 debacle. That's the theory. I don't know if the theory will be true, but I can see the logic, Jacob, right?
Yeah, they're trying to quickly get it through, like you said. And some of the measures, some of the changes to, for instance, CGT and negative gearing and the trusts, you know, they don't come in until the middle of next year and the year after that in 28. So people will have had a long time to come to terms with them, or, PK, get really, really angry about them. That's the other thing. But the thing is, they'll be law. So you can sort of... Yeah, it's an interesting bit of political psychology, isn't it? Do people continue to stay angry about something that's been legislated in the past compared to when it's yet to happen? In the case of the 2014 budget, like you said, all those things took years, years, years. They were grinding through the Senate, so people were constantly reminded of that budget. This gets done. It's in law. Do people move on? I don't know. It's so hard to gauge, isn't it? Because even in 2014, one of the memories I have of that budget was when it landed, there was a sort of oof sound as the air went out of everybody and it went really quiet. And then it built. The anger about that budget built. This, I don't know yet. It feels like, you know, history's never perfect in the way it matches up. I'm still waiting to see really how this all lands. There's a lot of social media stuff that's very interesting. People sort of making postings about the invisible partner that they never knew their business had. Some of that stuff's quite funny. It's all AI generated. But the point being, the government is now there, your invisible partner, and they'll take 47% of the capital gain of the visit, you know, hairdressing salon or nail polishing clinic. Is that what they're called? That you're sort of working on building up. So let's see how some of that plays out. Of course, the winners we were told in this budget would be younger people. And that, PK, I think is the longer term test into the next election. Does any of this move the dial on housing? And in 2028, will the government be able to point to evidence that it's been able to move the dial on housing? Will there be more millennials able to buy their first home, more Gen Z able to buy their first home? So it has a long tail, this budget, is my instinct.
Yeah, I mean, we've just had the first weekend post the changes where people knew that if they were an investor, they, you know, couldn't go and buy a property and be able to negatively gear it. And already we've seen some impact. You can't say it's all because of that, right? Because the market was already softening. We also know that clearance, like this has been, clearance rates have been higher. This has been a growing issue because of the war in Iran and the Strait of Hormuz and the general economic fallout. Yeah, the fallout from all of that, though, has meant that economic activity has shifted a bit. So it's a kind of perfect storm in some ways. Now, that might sound, you know, face value, if you're trying to sell your house, you'd kind of have the shits at the moment, if I can be clear, right? Because you're like, oh, thanks, government. Like, you know, you've another problem. You know, there's another side always, of course. This is why politics is not easy. You know, if you're selling your house at the moment, right, and then you don't have those investors also competing, i.e. you can't, inflate the cost of your house, that's also annoying for those people. Guess what? Those people also vote. So everything you do as a government has winners and losers if it's difficult. And you can see the losers. Like if you and I were to sell our house, we'd be like, oh, there's less people trying to buy it, right? Like that's the consequence.
But that's the risk, isn't it, PK, of any political reform, that you then get blamed for what happens. But I mean, this is also, to go back to the polls just quickly, this is what's spending your political capital looks like. And there's been a lot of people, particularly on the progressive side of politics, who have been saying well and truly for a year, but also much longer, they want this government to spend its political capital. Well, that's what this is. This is now the hit on their support in certain groups. They have to now explain why they did break those promises, and they have to explain why it's going to work. That's spending your political capital.
And so that's what they're currently doing. So the week after the budget is traditionally the week where the government hits the road to sell it, to explain it, to hit every, and the Prime Minister will be going to every part of the country, a gazillion press conferences with, today he did one in Adelaide with home buyers and, you know, trying to sell the narrative of their budget. So Parliament doesn't sit the week after. And the opposition leader's doing the same, explaining his, because of course, he had a pretty significant budget reply as well, with some big ideas in it that are becoming a little contested as well. Lots of issues with them. Now, the opposition is trying to get up some arguments at the moment about the government's proposals and then spruiking their own. They're trying to label the 30% tax on trusts as death tax by stealth, because they'll affect discretionary testamentary trusts. Did I get that right?
You did. And
does anyone understand anything about them?
It was very carefully said there, PK, on purpose.
Yeah,
because there are two types. There's the fixed testamentary trusts and discretionary ones. And the fixed ones are not affected, but the discretionary ones are. Government arguing the trustees can spread the benefit to different people in different proportions rather than an equal share to all members of the trust. And that's what they say is a design feature that allows tax minimization, because you put more into one of your members who has a low tax-free threshold or doesn't earn very much income in that year, and you don't put it into someone who has a high income. Death duty or death tax by stealth is one of those politically potent lines. The government's arguing that this change hasn't really affected that. You can still pass that stuff on in a fixed trust. This just minimises the ability of that shifting that goes on. Again, I don't think this is much different to where we were on budget night or the day after, but The big setup here in my mind is that the opposition, Angus Taylor in his budget reply speech, wants to bring in indexation of income tax thresholds. Very technical area, but essentially it's simpler. In simple terms, he's saying he's going to stop the thing that happens every year where government effectively taxes people more because you get a pay rise and suddenly you're in a higher tax bracket. That tax bracket doesn't change, whereas inflation, of course, is always rising. And so over the years, government's collecting more money for you, from you. And that can be, you know, hundreds of dollars. It could be thousands of dollars additional tax every year. He's gonna stop all that. It's one of the most radical things you could do to the tax system. And they've tried it before, and it will put enormous pressure on him every year to find that amount of money from elsewhere, either through spending cuts or other measures, other taxes. And if you don't, PK, you have bigger budget deficits, more debt. So it's this huge straitjacket he's willingly putting around himself to make a virtue of indexation. And it's something that also blunts the traditional political game, which is these stealth taxes raise more money every year and then governments tend to give them back. And that's what Labor's doing with the WETO, the Working Australians tax offset. Did I get that right? I've already forgotten what that's called.
The WATO. It's what I call it. The WATO. I'm a bogan.
And that, of course, is one way in which governments do this type of thing, where they give you the money back over a longer period of time. But that is, Labor's going to be defending the status quo of the way we do income tax, and Angus Taylor wants to dismantle it. Big, big risks on both sides. But I think for voters, that's a real difference now.
Yes, Absolutely. It's a real difference and a real policy debate, and that's the best part of the last week for me, that we're actually
absolutely
finally engaging in some real ideas that might shift the dial on Australians and working and, you know,
politics
I think
is back.
Yeah, and also PAYG taxpayers, people who use their labour every single day to earn an income, are the ones that I think are the most, you know, a lot of economists will say this, this isn't my own view, have really been punished by the structure of our tax system.
We have, and so we have the highest reliance of any OECD country on income tax, barring Denmark. Mm-hmm. In terms of our entire tax take, it's in the high 40% of total government revenue comes in via income taxes. That's incredibly high by any other comparative economy, where they tend to have much higher GST equivalents. They'll have goods and services taxes of 20% VATs, and then they'll have lower income taxes. We're the other way around, so we put an incredible amount of weight on income taxes. And that's where this fight now that we have between the two sides of politics is so interesting. Now, liberals will tell you that taking the burden off income taxes is a great idea because it encourages people to work harder and earn more money, less of it going to the government. That's a traditional liberal argument. But as Wayne Swan, in a quite an interesting speech last week on Friday, laid out the argument for, well, actually, governments have to provide services. And what kind of an Australia do we want? Do we want to go down the path of a US-type arrangement where, frankly, there's no universal health care, there's all sorts of welfare problems, and he argues a broken society that elects a Donald Trump, or indeed a Pauline Hanson. So he's very worried about the populist wave in Australia, and he's saying Labor has an argument. He won't say it as explicitly as this, but the higher taxes buys a more happy population, I guess, because you from Labor's point of view, you redistribute the money more effectively to look after people so you don't end up with that political backlash. Is that an argument? I mean, I don't know. That's how I sort of see the difference now between the two. And I think it's been an awfully long time since it's been that explicit.
Yeah, I think it is rather explicit at the moment. I just want to pivot, if we can, also to another part of the coalition's announcements that has been very contentious. And I had a story, it's still there, it's in the show notes, it's on ABC online. I spoke to moderate Liberal Andrew McLaughlin, who's really broken ranks with his own party on what he thinks is creating two types of community members among our migrants because of the policy his own party introduced, or announced rather, as their policy in the budget reply. Now, I reckon that is, you know, I know he's just one guy and he's in the moderate wing and he's absolutely in the minority, but it's a real, for him, I think, my analysis of him speaking is him kind of signalling there are liberals like him who still believe in a perhaps an older version of multiculturalism, which has become a little unfashionable now on the right side of politics, Jacob. Am I right?
Yeah, yeah. And I think this is a sort of a little echoing cry from the very diminished moderate wing of the Liberal Party of concern. I think it's really interesting. You got that interview with him and that line was really absent last week when it was more about how Angus Taylor was trying to go after the One Nation vote by bringing in this policy of denying 17 different types of welfare to permanent residents. The obvious question for me is, well, then do they get a discount on their income taxes for that proportion of the welfare budget? Because they all pay tax here. They pay tax here. So they're suddenly being told they can't access the welfare that their taxes contribute to. So some countries actually do this type of thing as Angus Taylor would like to do. I don't know that it's great. That doesn't strike me as fairness, but he's obviously talking to a group of voters who are very concerned that people are coming to this country and getting access to all kinds of welfare. I think there's a lot to unpack there, PK. It's very hard to come to this country with a disability, for instance. You get scrutinized very, very heavily. because they don't want people coming to our country and going onto the NDIS. That already exists as part of the immigration system. But he's saying things like the 5% deposit guarantee on first home buyers. That's something that a permanent resident has access to. Angus Taylor wants to take that away. Now, PRs, as they're called, don't vote. So if they're really, really angry, maybe they have to join and become Australian citizens and vote their displeasure if they are angry about it.
They don't vote, but guess who votes? Their relatives.
Some do. Yeah, exactly. So there's a lot of people where there's multiple categories within one family. There'll be citizens, there'll be permanent residents and others. And yeah, I think your point there about, and as was found in the Liberal Party review that was done on the last year, on the election last year, they have a big problem with migrant communities. And I'm not sure how much of this helps, but I'm also, I'd want to see some hard data on it too, because some migrant communities who do go the full hog and become citizens, they can often be quite critical of people who are still leaving one foot, you know, across the pond somewhere.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, that's, you know, like anything, there's lots of views in every community. It's, no one is a sort of a homogenous political view in any community. But when you have the deep-rooted electoral problem that the Liberal Party does have, and everyone knows they have it, they know they have it, then it becomes a harder ask to try and overcome that if you are sending these messages. Now, I've spoken to other Liberals who've said, you know, that they're impressed with the taxation policy that was announced by Angus Taylor. Why did he need to muddy the waters with the other, you know, messages? Like, the tax one's big bang enough. Now, we know why. Post-Farrah, right? Like, he's trying to send a message. But, you know, is he causing perhaps, and it's all to be revealed, but is he perhaps causing himself more pain in the longer term?
He needed to come out of his budget reply speech with a number of fights, or maybe just one big fight. But the point was, he needed to be out there with something that demonstrated he was different to One Nation, different to Labor, and having a fight over an issue that Liberals care about and middle-of-the-road voters care about. That was the primary task, because he's been leader now for almost, 3 months now maybe? I've just lost track of time, a fair chunk of time, and he hasn't troubled the scorers really at all in terms of moving the dial on polls or picking up a groundswell of support over an idea. The speech on Thursday was about finding something like that. Now, he's shot one rocket off to the right on immigration to try and pull back voters who are going off and flirting with One Nation over immigration. And then he's fired another rocket straight down through middle Australia on the income tax question. Maybe you're right. Maybe one blunts the other. But I think he's trying to do multiple things at once because, frankly, he is up against it. He is badly cornered. He knows he doesn't have an awful lot of time, or at least he should know he doesn't have an awful lot of time to get this right. And Labor continues to dominate. I mean, last week we saw yet another senator join Labor's ranks just to really put salt in the wounds. Mm.
But we're also seeing at the same time, you know, go back to Angus Taylor's conundrum people, and that they're just, you know, still marginal people, but people like, for instance, Holly Hughes, who's now not in the parliament, but she's joined One Nation.
Yeah, PK. So, yes. So this morning we did get that news, didn't we, that Tina McQueen and Holly Hughes, the latter was a former Liberal MP and she lost her seat a while back. They are now putting their hand up to become One Nation candidates.
Yep. I mean, One Nation is recruiting, right? They are genuinely recruiting, and they're recruiting because look at the polling, look at Farrah. It makes sense to me that people are wanting to join what they see as a successful political movement and not one that's on a downward trajectory as they see it.
Isn't the danger for One Nation though that they get a whole lot of has-beens and once were's and never quite were's with some of these folks? I'm not suggesting the people we've just named are that, but there is a bit of it. I mean, there was Corey Bernardi in South Australia. These are all people who had a big career previously in the Liberal Party, now suddenly, brushing off their CVs and throwing their hands back into the ring.
It's funny, isn't it? It's just like, I'm going to shift here.
Yeah.
And that's what's happening with Reform UK too. A lot of former Tories, I'm just going to shift here. So it's like, oh, my brand stinks. I'm just going to go to a new brand, but I don't see any of these people changing.
It does seem a little opportunistic, but I guess that's politics. You go for it when you can, don't you?
It's all politics. And that's it for politics now today, Jacob. Thanks for joining me.
My pleasure, PK.
Tomorrow I'll be joined by Raf Epstein to bring you the latest developments. If you have a question for us, send it to thepartyroom@abc.net.au. See you, Jacob.
Take care. All the best.